From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Michigan's senior senator talks about U.S. attacks on Iran.
The president still has to come before Congress and talk about what he expects to accomplish. A president can't just go into war without the support of the American people, and that support is expressed by the Congress.
Then a woman whose father was picked up on the job by ICE and detained for months talks about what she wants to offer to others in the same situation.
When he stepped into presidency in January of last year, we sat down as a family and actually discussed a plan because we knew that it was going to get pretty bad.
And fiber artist Carol Harris talks about her work and the mindfulness of quilting.
Well, it's all improvisation. I never have a blueprint to begin with. The journey is part of the joy for me.
Those stories and more coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, a conversation with a Detroit artist who's working with themes of transformation, memory, and time through her quilting.
It's very personal. I really enjoy just sitting there, touching, feeling the cloth, and you know, that needle going in and out, back and forth. It's very meditative.
That's a little bit later this hour, but first, the war in the Middle East continues to broaden. Military facilities in Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates have all been hit with retaliatory attacks from Iran. All these countries are members of the Gulf Cooperation Council and allies of the United States. Some Michigan lawmakers are weighing in on the ongoing military operations involving Iran, including U.S. Senator Gary Peters. He serves on the Senate Armed Services Committee and has sponsored several bills related to military operations and readiness. Senator Peters, welcome back to Stateside.
Good to be with you.
You have spoken in the past along lines that agree with the Trump administration's contention that Iran has been acting counter to U.S. interests in a number of ways. There are its nuclear ambitions, its funding for paranational groups like Hezbollah. I wonder, in your experience, if you think attacks like these will achieve America's foreign policy goals.
Well, there's no question that Iran is a bad actor. They're a destabilizing force and have caused incredible hardship, not just in the Middle East, but in other places around the world. So they are not our friend. They are folks that we have to take very seriously as a threat to the United States and our citizens, both here as well as abroad. But in terms of this operation, the president still has to come before Congress and talk about what he expects to accomplish. A president can't just go into war without the support of the American people, and that support is expressed by the Congress, which is why we need you need to have a declaration of war, or at least the passage of an authorization for military force, as we've done in prior conflicts. None of that has occurred in this case. This is not an imminent threat. And let me be clear, you don't need that kind of authorization if there's an imminent threat to the United States. The president needs to protect us, and we want him or her to do that if there's an imminent threat. But that didn't occur here as far as we can see. There's no evidence. Initially, the president talked about nuclear weapons. And yet, if you recall, the last attack to take out some of the enrichment facilities was deemed completely successful and halted the program. Now, president saying, well, that isn't true. What he said wasn't true, that they're needed. But now he's backing off on that statement. Then he wanted to talk about protesters. Now he's talking about missile sites. It just seems as if he's going about this on the seat of his pants.
How do you see our responsibilities in Iran right now? We may be relatively early into a military engagement, but having attacked the country now, what do you see? Is the United States truly responsible for a regime change?
We'll see if there's. I doubt that you're going to see a regime change, at least with what we're doing right now with these air attacks. You know, the Iranian regime is pretty strong on the ground. They're brutal. We saw what they did with protesters just recently, killing thousands of them. There's no evidence that regime will fall apart as a result of air attacks. It could happen, but you know, history has proven that isn't the case, that you need more than that. I don't know what the president has in his what his plans are, which is part of the problem. We have no idea what those plans are, if he has them. And so it's difficult to know what will go forward. I suspect you're going to have a succession plan for leadership in Iran. The leader who was killed, as many know, he was an elderly man, 86, and I understand he was in pretty serious health issues, so he was not likely to live long. So I'm sure they have plans to put somebody else in place, and you never know who the next person is. They could be worse.
We have just about a minute left, Senator. At this point, it seems like opinion in Congress is once again divided along party lines. And I wondered if there has been talk amongst the relevant committees that you serve on along anything other than partisan lines.
It's mostly partisan, unfortunately. There are a few Republicans that are asking questions. And that's what's so disappointing, because this is a constitutional issue. You know, our founders were very clear that the Congress has to make these decisions. They didn't trust a president. They didn't trust a king. They just defeated a king. They thought a president with these kinds of war powers would be dangerous across the entire fabric of the government. And they expected Congress to assert their responsibilities as a co-equal branch of government. Unfortunately, most of my Republican colleagues don't see themselves as an independent branch of government. They just see themselves as a rubber stamp to the president. And the only questions I've ever heard them ask of the president when he asks them to jump is, how high does he want them to jump? That's not the role of a U.S. senator or a U.S. House of Representatives member. We need to be a co-equal branch and ask the hard questions and demand answers on behalf of the American people.
Gary Peters is Michigan's senior senator. Senator, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right now, there are more than 1,400 people detained at the North Lake Processing Center in Baldwin, Michigan. The majority of them have not been charged with a crime, and yet they remain inside a facility that was once the home of a privately owned federal prison. It's now rebranded as an immigrant detention center, and it's the largest of its kind in the Midwest. There are people here awaiting court hearings, deportation, and it was a place that Samantha Ramirez never thought she'd have to visit until her dad, Fernando, was detained late last year. The experience drove her and her sister, Naomi, to start a group to help families through these experiences. Samantha Ramirez lives in West Michigan, and she joins us now. Hey, Samantha, thank you for taking a minute.
Yeah, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm all right. Can you take us back to that day last September and how you found out that your dad had been taken to North Lake? And, I mean, how was he arrested?
So it was just a random call, and I'm not one to talk on the phone, so dad knows to like just text me. So when he called, I knew, you know, something was up. So when I answered, he's a trucker, or he was a trucker, and he was on his way home from a delivery and went through the Indiana wait stop right at the edge of Indiana and Michigan. So like the last wait station. They were pulling all the trucks in just to weigh them as they're supposed to. But when he pulled in, the, you know, state troopers were there and a third party bounty hunting company was there as well. When he went up to his turn, they went up to him and told him like, hey, you need to give us, you know, your license, gave it to him. Then they wanted, you know, proof that he was supposed to be here. So he gave him his work permit because he has a legal work permit. So when he called me, the first thing he said, he goes, hey, I think they're going to be taking me. I had to pull into the wait station and they just took all my documentation and they've had me sitting here for 15 minutes now. So I stayed on the phone with him. And, you know, I was there or I was on the phone when the officer came up or whatever he is, came up to him and said, we can't find you in the system. So you have to come with us. And so he had to hang up. He's like, I got to hang up. So it was a panic, really. Just to know that he's so far away and he couldn't call me anymore. I kept trying to call back and I couldn't, you know, get an answer from him. So I knew it was real, you know, it was unbelievable.
I did not realize that federal agents were picking people up at way stations these days.
Yeah, it's actually happening quite a bit. They're taking a lot of semi-truck drivers. Dad was one of a few that were actually taken that day. It was him and a small group of people. that were also truckers, and they were all detained. And they're doing that right now with all a lot. There's a lot of semi-truck drivers in the facility right now.
Before this happened, can I ask a little bit about what you would have said you thought about the immigration enforcement system? And I just kind of wondered, you know, where you were with all this before your family, before this happened to your family.
We've always fought for immigrant rights, truly, because our family is immigrants. You know, we've been here forever. Me and my sister and my brother, we were born in California. We moved to Michigan in 97, and Michigan has been home since the beginning. But we were never against, like, you know, deporting people that do have crimes, criminals, that sort of thing. And so that's kind of what we were hoping for. When he stepped into presidency in January of last year, we sat down as a family and actually discussed a plan because we knew that it was going to get pretty bad.
Well, you're saying when Donald Trump was elected. Yeah.
The moment he was elected, we had a family meeting and we're like, what are we going to do if one of you guys get grabbed? Dad was never part of that plan because he had a work permit. We're like, you're fine, you're good. But when Dad got taken, it kind of derailed the plans because Dad wasn't supposed to ever be taken. He doesn't have a criminal record. He has a work permit. He's been renewing that work permit since like 2008, 2009. So like he was in the system. They just said he wasn't, but they took him. So we've always been, you know, pro-immigration policies. Like we need better ways of allowing people to live and work here, and we just don't have that.
We're speaking today with Samantha Ramirez, the co-founder of Raíces Migrantes, which provides assistance for Michiganders whose family members have been detained by ICE or Customs and Border Protection.
A lot of the people in Northlake aren't from Michigan. There's some from Illinois, Ohio. I think there's some from New York. Like they're from a whole bunch of different states. And so when they get released, who's going to pick them up?
More with Samantha in just a moment. You're with Stateside. What's on your mind these days? We do love hearing from you, especially if there's a story or question we might be able to tackle. Anything specific to elections that you're curious about? What's the Michigan road trip you're most looking forward to taking this year? You can drop an email. The address is stateside@michiganpublic.org. Or maybe you'd rather leave a message on social media for us. We'll see it if you post on the Michigan Public Facebook page, or you can also DM us on Instagram or TikTok. Our handles on both of those platforms are at Michigan Public. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's get back now to my conversation with Samantha Ramirez. Her father, Fernando, was detained at a highway weigh station and taken to Northlake Processing Center in Baldwin, even though he had a permit to work here in Michigan. Weeks went by with few to no answers as to why he was detained or when he would be released. Through that experience, Samantha co-founded a group called Raíces Migrantes. They help families who have a loved one who's going through immigrant detention. So for those who don't know much about Northlake, can you describe it? I was curious about what your experience was of walking into that facility.
Yeah, it's actually threw up the first time I went. I was so nervous because you walk in and well, when you drive in, you first drive in, it's in the middle of nowhere. There's like nothing surrounding it. The first time we went, it was a visitation at like 7, so it was already dark and it's pitch black out there. And so it's very much a prison. It's cold. They have, you know, a scanner or like a metal detector so that you have to walk in to make sure that you don't have anything metal. You can't bring your phones in. They take you through like these locking doors, and you have to wait for every single door to open and close behind you before you can even walk through. And then you walk through and you see the most ironic sign. It's handwritten, hand drawn. It has the state of Michigan. It says Northlake welcomes you. And it's right on display behind these big glass windows. And I have issue. I have beef with that sign. I really hate it every time I see it.
Yeah, that's wild. It sounds like it looks like what it used to be, which is a prison. How did that environment affect your dad?
He's pretty resilient. He's a big jokester. He loves making friends. He loves talking. So it was really hard to see him getting quieter. He tried his best to stay strong. He went from being like the super bubbly, happy go lucky guy to being a little more stoic, a little more serious. Towards the end of his time there, he missed all the holidays. He missed Thanksgiving, he missed Christmas, the New Year. And I think that's what really affected him the most is that. So he did get pretty serious towards the end, less joking. It definitely did affect his mental health, as it does to everyone there. And it didn't help either that he was seeing his friends be deported after being here for so many years and losing money to lawyers who didn't actually do what they were supposed to do, or they messed up something, and because of that, they ended up getting deported. So I think it was just a lot of heartbreak in one spot.
So your dad was there for about 3.5 months, and he was released in January, but I understand there was a point where you weren't really sure if he was going to get out. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So when we first started talking, we had a lawyer who had been his lawyer for years and years with his work permit and his other stuff. And when he got caught, we called them really quick to be like, hey, this is what's going on. Well, this guy left him there for about 2 weeks without doing anything because turns out he was waiting for more money to file anything, to do anything. So the money we had already given him, because technically it was a new case, wasn't used for anything. He was still waiting for us to pay him more. And so when we started looking around for different lawyers, the three lawyers we spoke with looked at his case and were like, there's no possibility. Whatever lawyer you had before misled you. Like there's no way for him to fight this. And so they said that the best course of action was to, self-deport, do the self-deportation, turn in his ticket, and maybe we could ask for them back, and so that's what we did. We went straight to immigration in Detroit, spoke with someone. We're like, dad wants to waive his rights to a court hearing, because that's when you need a lawyer, really. He's waiving his rights to the court hearing. She went to talk to the prosecutors for immigration, and they're like, no, he can't waive his rights. We want to open his case. We want to open his case and go through it. We told her, we're like, we're not trying to fight the case. We already know that it's not a winnable case. He's going to be safer and more healthy in Mexico than being locked up, where it took them about a week to get him his medication, and he is on insulin. So it was very dire for us to like get him out of there, where he was going to be safer. And so she offered us to do the incentivized voluntary deportation, where supposedly they get, I think, $3,000. I'm not sure. I might be off on that.
Folks are offered money to leave the country voluntarily.
Correct. And so that's what she said she was going to have him do. And I said, okay. And a month went by, nothing. Another month went by, nothing. And there's only like one immigration officer for that whole facility. So if they have like 1,400 people, probably more now, a lot more now, one immigration officer for like that whole facility is insane.
So going through all this, I mean, this is just like a crazy amount of bureaucracy, and really a pretty harrowing experience for your dad. What was the moment that made you and Naomi realize, your sister, that we have to do something to help other people with this?
Pretty much from the get-go, the reason that dad was able to get in contact with us, because here's the thing, we don't remember phone numbers anymore. We don't have the necessity to remember phone numbers. And so unfortunately, he did not remember any of our phone numbers. He remembered one friend's phone number in California who has never changed his number before, but he didn't have money. And a young man went up to him and said, hey, have you spoken with your family? And he said, no, I don't have any money. I'm waiting for them to put some money in my account so I can call them. He goes, no, come here. Come with me. I'll let you borrow my phone, my credit, so you can call your family. And so he was able to call his friend, because that's the only person he remembered. He was able to call his friend. His friend called us and said, your dad is in North Lake right now. because we had no idea where he was. He was showing up in Broadview and then he disappeared for a couple of days and we had no idea where he was until his friend called us. And so once we got in contact with him, I was like, "Do you know that guy?" He's like, "No, he was just offering his phone credits to me and a couple of other guys who didn't have money so that we could call our family and get set up." And I was like, "That was really nice. You do the same. Like, do the same, Dad. Like, you tell me and we'll put money in your account. And as people come in, if they haven't talked to their families or can't talk to their families, you let them use your phone." He's like, "Yeah, for sure." So that's kind of how it started. We started putting money in his account so that he could call us, but also could help other people. And from there, it went from helping new people get in contact with their family to him calling us and be like, "Hey, I found this, 70-year-old man who hasn't been able to speak to his family since he's been here for months because they don't know how to deposit money into his account. So he hasn't been able to speak to his family for like more than a month and a half." And so we got in contact with his family. He remembered the numbers. So we were able to get in contact with his sons and explain to them how to deposit. They still couldn't figure it out. So I was like, "You know what? Just cash out me the money. I will deposit it for you because I had an account." And so that's kind of how that started. We started, they would send us money to deposit into, their family members' accounts. And then once that happened, it turned to they don't know how to set up accounts, and we would just bring our computers or we'll bring our phones and be like, "Come with us, let's get you signed up." And we would help them sign up. They would choose their password, and then we would be like, "All right, give me your license. Let's go ahead and verify it." And so we would do it for them, with them there, so that they had a way to get access to their family members. Because if you don't have the Getting Out app or the Getting Out visitation app, the phones won't connect. And you can't have video calls without those two apps. So it was really important for us to be able to help people get that set up. So it's kind of how it started. It started from the very beginning. We just told them, like, "We got to help the people that need help in here, And it kind of snowballed from there. We met Rebecca later, who runs Reencuentros de la Luz in Chicago. We met her because her brother-in-law was in there, and she was turned away from visitation. She had driven from Wisconsin and was turned away from visitation, even though she had, driven hours. And with her and me, we both kind of pushed back a bit, asked for supervisors, et cetera. There was like five more families that were being turned away, and we're like, "Use your heart. Like, look at these people. They're desperate to see and make sure that their families are okay. And they drove for hours. They haven't slept. Like, please be empathetic, be human, and let them in." And they did. They let those five families come in, because I was like, take 30 minutes of my time. Like, take 30 minutes of my time. I'm sure if you ask anyone else, if you take 30 minutes of everyone else's time, they'll be able to get in." And I really fought for it, because that day, I had walked in with a wife of another detainee that my dad actually knew, who was from Grand Rapids, and they were friendly. And her and her children hadn't been able to see him since he had gotten detained, because every time they came, they were being denied because they ran out of room, because you had to be there hours and hours ahead of time before the actual appointment to even get access to them. And so that's one of the main reasons that I was really fighting hard with Rebecca to get them in, because I just couldn't stand the sadness in his daughter's face. It was heartbreaking.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Samantha Ramirez. She's the co-founder of a group called Raíces Migrantes that helps families who have loved ones who are going through immigration detention right now. Samantha, what are the different kinds of support? I mean, it really sounds like some people are starting from zero with this. I mean, they may have very little in terms of resources or in terms of transportation that's needed to be there. Can you give us a sense of the range of different kinds of help that you're trying to give to people?
So we help people set up accounts for communication. We are trying to connect the detainees with their families, because again, sometimes they just don't remember their phone numbers. So we try to find them on Facebook and message them, like, "Hey, we heard from your family member." Or sometimes if they do remember the phone numbers, the family's not picking up because it's an 800 number. And so we'll text them and let them know, like, "Hey, your family reached out to us. this is the number that they're going to call you from. This is how you set this up. And then we will send them the links. We've also started sending or like connecting them to resources for like financial assistance, because a lot of times the men that are taken, they have families and they're the main breadwinner. And so now the wives are struggling to pay rent and buy food, et cetera. So we've been looking for resources that are solid and valid and not going to take advantage of people and send those along. Same with like lawyers. I have a group of lawyers that we've used and know they do a good job, and I send those along, and they're not free or anything, but I know that they do good work and that they're solid people, because we've heard just far too many stories of lawyers taking advantage of the situation. Like we went through it too. And so we didn't want that to happen. So I've been sending that. We also send them resources for like MERC, how to call into MERC, so the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, and just a bunch of different resources that they can reach out to and get assistance with. And then we're also depositing and like fundraising to deposit money into people's accounts for commissary, because the food there is terrible. We've heard lots of stories of where the food looks suspicious and they're like, we're not eating that, we're going to get sick. You can imagine if there's people there who have no money, no family, no help, they're really, really suffering, especially if they don't speak English, you know. There's no way for them to get any assistance. So that's what we've been doing too. And we help coordinate rides home. So we have a great group of volunteers. We love them. They take time out of their day to go and pick these people up as they're being released on the habeas or for other reasons. Because again, a lot of the people in Northlake aren't from Michigan. There's some from Illinois, Ohio. I think there's some from New York. Like they're from a whole bunch of different states. And so when they get released, who's going to pick them up? Who can pick them up?
People might have heard that, like, there have been people from Michigan who end up in detention, say, in Texas. Is part of what you're doing coordinating rides that may need to happen from other places?
That's what we're trying to do. It first started off with Northlake, but we have started getting requests from other states. So, and we have been able to get people from Northlake to like other states. I know Rebecca, who's with the Facebook on in Chicago, she managed to get connections in Kentucky. So now we can assist people being released in Kentucky come back to Illinois and Michigan and that sort of thing. So she does have drivers down there that are able to do that. But that is our goal, is to connect with as many detention centers as we can so that we can get them back home, especially if they're in the winter states, you know, Michigan, Minnesota, other states, because a lot of them were taken from work or taken on their way to work. Sometimes some were taken in like the fall or the spring, summer. It's winter, it's cold, and they'll just release them without a jacket. So when we go to pick them up, we have a bunch of donations from a lot of great people. We have a bunch of jackets. We even have clean clothes of most sizes. So we ask them, like, do you need a fresh pair of like clothes? And most of the time it's, no, I'm okay with the clothes, but I do need a jacket.
I think it might be worth repeating that everyone who's in this situation, it's not like people are getting paid to help each other. It's just that everyone is kind of in the same boat trying to help their family members, their loved ones. And the connections that you're talking about out of state, can you say a little bit more about how you've seen communities start to form? I mean, I know it's not easy because the place where you may need to arrange a ride for someone may be in a state where you don't really know anybody. How, what have you seen of connections or communities being formed out of these challenges?
It's been awe-inspiring, truly, to see how many people have stepped up. The Facebook page and sharing has been the way that we've really been connecting with a lot of people. So we did start getting connected to, you know, other groups within Michigan to try to make it as easy as possible to help these people. And from there, because they have more connections in other states, we found people, you know, obviously in Illinois. We have people, like, I think we have some in Ohio, and then now we have people in Kentucky. So really, it's kind of amazing seeing how the fire is lit in everyone's heart in the face of all of these atrocities, there are many, many people stepping up and creating their own little groups and going from there.
Yeah. Without anything, I don't want to ask you to say anything that might jeopardize your dad's legal situation, but is there anything you can tell us about where his legal process is right now?
We definitely have a game plan with our new lawyer. He's great. It's going to be a little bit until we really know what the next steps are. I do know he has another court case in the summer. We're pretty comfortable with what this game plan is, of course. At the end of it, we do have to sell our family home, because we're in a multi-generational house. So I live with my parents and my kids live with us, obviously. And so they've grown up with grandma and grandpa, right there. So it's gonna be hard, but we have a plan in place.
Samantha Ramirez is the co-founder of Raíces Migrantes. Samantha, thank you so much for talking to us and for sharing your family's experience. I know this is a lot.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks.
We're going to take a moment now. After that, a Detroit-based fiber artist talks to us about her decades-long career experimenting with quilt making. We'll be right back. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The Flynn Institute of Arts has opened an exhibition called Threads of Time, which explores the decades-long career of Detroit artist Carol Harris. She's known for pushing the boundaries of traditional quilting through layering textures and abstract shapes. She draws inspiration from Japanese patchwork mending tradition and, of course, from her very own hometown, themes of transformation, themes of memory, and the passage of time. Harris uses a wide range of materials, vintage fabrics and hand-dyed cloth and found objects, sometimes painting or even burning fabric, to create densely layered compositions of textiles. She was recognized with a Kresge Visual Arts Fellowship in 2015, and her work has shown nationally and internationally. Carol will be giving an artist talk at the FIA this Saturday. Carol Harris, welcome to Stateside. It's so good to have you.
Thank you. Very good to be here.
I wanted to start by just asking about one of your first works, The Wedding Quilt, that folks may have seen at some of your exhibitions. Can you tell us the origin story of how that one came to be?
Yeah, that was my very first quilt, and I made it, started in 1966, the year I got married. And it actually was to commemorate my marriage to my husband, Bill, who is still my husband. We're celebrating 60 years this year.
Well, congratulations.
And the previous year I had been in a wedding, and the wedding couple received this magnificent quilt as a gift from one of the bride's family members. The quilt was the pattern called pine burr, which is made up of a million little triangles that are folded and then attached to a foundation. And it's very, very heavy. But that was kind of my first encounter with a real, personal quilt. I don't come from a quilting family. And when Bill and I were about to be married, I thought, well, that's a good idea, but I don't have any family members who will be so generous as to give me a quilt. So I have sewn all my life. So I had lots of scraps around, and that's how my quilt started.
Can I ask what the handwork of quilting meant to you at that stage of your creative life?
Well, yeah, I had been making my own clothes for many years at that point. So some of those scraps that I had is what went into it. But I think that I stitched the pieces together by machine, but I did quilt the three layers, the top, the middle, and the back. I did quilt do all those by hand. And I still enjoy very much hand quilting. It's very personal, very meditative, and and again, I don't even remember what I was thinking about then, but I knew that that was how it was done. I didn't really want to do do the actual quilting by machine.
I mean, the practice of quilting really does seem very tied in with time, both in terms of how the finished products, whether they're, you know, a work of contemporary art or whether they're a work of craft and contemporary craft. I mean, they mean a lot to us over time because of how they are received and handed down, but also because of the work that is in them.
Right. And it's very personal. You know, I really enjoy just sitting there touching, feeling the cloth and, you know, that needle going in and out back and forth. It's very meditative, and I have time to think and meditate while I'm doing that. I enjoy the quiet. I often listen to music while I'm working, but I prefer not to when I'm actually doing the handwork because it connects me to myself, I think. Yeah, and I feel like actually I make music when I'm doing that.
That's lovely. Your work has explored a lot of different styles and mm-hmm. a lot of different ways of working in medium. Almost all of your compositions have an element of the organic, you know, something that looks like it might be you know, a pool of liquid, and mm-hmm. and at the same time, you know, sort of the geometric forms that a lot of us associate with quilting, that, you know, in later works we can say these are very modern. can you maybe tell us about how your sense of possibility evolved both as you worked on your own things and as you sort of explored the more global quilting tradition?
Sure. Well, okay, my earlier work is very, well, it's sort of very typical of what you might think of as quilting. It's modular, very geometric. But I think at heart, I really am a designer. And I make sure that I made sure in that earlier work and even in more organic work today, I make sure that, first of all, that it is a well-designed piece, even though my later ones that you're speaking of that look so organic are very, well, it's all improvisational. I never have a blueprint to begin with. The journey is part of the joy for me, or most of the joy, actually, figuring out where it's going and how to get there.
The architecture and cityscape of Detroit is something you've talked about as playing a role in your eye. What are some ways that the city has manifested in your work?
Well, that's a good question. As my day job was in interior design, so architecture was always influencing and a part of my other career as a quilter. I have had a dual career ever since I started making art and ever since I started working after college. So yeah, this architectural thing has always been a part of, you know, of what my quilts were, how I plan the space or how the spaces in the pieces work for me were a result of looking at blueprints and buildings and building materials all day, every day. At one point, I thought that the two were separate, but it's not. You know, they were all a part of how I see things.
Yeah. There are some forms and quilts that you've done that actually, you know, do have lines that people might, you know, people might interpret as skyline. There's one quilt called Reconstruction that's got sort of an inverted skyline. But some of your quilts, especially in the exhibition, they almost come across to me as, you know, maps, the marriage of, you know, some different kinds of things that might suggest, you know, an interior, the city of the interior, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, that's a very good observation, because I do think of many of them as maps. I'm influenced by a lot of things. I think the mapping thing comes from flight. You know, when I'm in an airplane looking out, you can see these blocks, which eventually kind of become compositions that make up a quilt. There's also the way that I actually quilt sometimes on the machine. These lines are reminiscent of the lines on a map, you know, longitude or latitude, whatever. So, you know, there's a lot coming in and going out. That just sort of pull from my internal computer as I'm working.
Yeah. Can you maybe say a little bit about how traveling has influenced things that you wanted to try in your quilting or things that you thought might be possible?
Again, talking about some of the more recent work, which is a lot more organic, is influenced by Japanese boro. It's a type of quilting, actually, piecework that was like American quilting was necessitated by not so much by time, but by, well, just by necessity, by preserving what materials you had on hand. Actually, in Japanese, the word boro means rag. So when I discovered or encountered, I want to say when I encountered Japanese boro, it sort of changed the way I looked at everything, really. And even the cityscape series, I'm now looking rather than big blocks of space, I'm going looking more detailed and looking at what happened to those surfaces or those buildings over time. So, and the marks that are made on the buildings, and we had a lot of that in Detroit, maybe 20 years ago. There's still a lot of those marks. But I, you know, if we were getting a lot of bad press about the city and how it was filled with ruin porn, and I sort of had a pushback from that. I didn't see ruin porn. I saw beauty in the marks that time made. So my work started to change then, and I started to have like a softer palette. Previously, I used a lot of really intense color. I still use a lot of color, but now it's softened. You know, I do things to make it appear worn or that it was impacted by time. So, you know, I may over dye. As you mentioned earlier, I may burn. So I do some burning. I do a lot of rust dyeing with rusty pieces of metal that I find, you know, everywhere. You know, Detroit is an industrial, post-industrial, I guess, city now. So there's a lot of metal things, you know, a lot of cars. Things fall off of cars all the time, and I use that in my process very often.
If you're just joining us, my guest is artist Carol Harris. She's the subject of a one-woman show at the Flint Institute of Art, The Threads of Time, and she'll be providing an artist talk this Saturday at the FIA Theater. You know, the process of showing work, sometimes artists feel like it's itself kind of a catalytic moment because, like, watching people interact with the work can maybe change the way that an artist feels about it. And I wonder if that was your experience.
Well, sometimes it does change the way or adds to the way I feel about the work. I enjoy having people look at my work. And one of the I'm not real good at or happy about titles necessarily. I would rather, I'd actually rather just number everything because I think that having viewers give me their impression of what's going on or what they see, you know, is very helpful to me. Actually, a lot of times people see things in the work that maybe was sort of subconscious to me, not th necessarily things that I saw when I was doing, but I love that people look at the work and they say, "Oh, well, you know, this reminds me of blah 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 blah," or "I remember this and I see this in the work." And so there are things that often I don't see, but I love people's interaction. I think it the viewer and myself are sort of in collaboration about the work. I don't think that it becomes real until somebody actually sees it and is touched by it.
Yeah. Something that you said about seeing work in Japan really kind of struck me. You said that you saw artists who were preserving what they had access to. I mean, we can say about quilting traditions in many parts of the world as a craft tradition that it's about working with what you have and often preserving what we have. But so much of the contemporary quilt scene, like we now as consumers are, I mean, artists, you know, are in a way a consumer. We have access to so many different kinds of materials, you know, from global markets. And I mean, those are very useful things for every quilter who's trying to, you know, who's trying to express themselves and say something. But also, you know, it can disconnect you from the artist's personal history in a lot of ways. Are there certain materials that you find especially meaningful, either because they have been good tools for you know, good mediums for you in that way, or because they provide a sense of connection?
I don't necessarily approach my work that way. I think quilting, actually, in terms of preserving, is one of the earliest forms of sustainability. African Americans made quilts out of necessity because they didn't have anything else. And I'm sure Boro, the Japanese Boro pieces, come from the same tradition. But yeah, my earlier work was not so much about sustainability. It was just, I was collecting beautiful cloth. I love cloth. And everywhere I travel, I look for it, except maybe in the last 5, 10 years, I have so much that I don't need to add to it anymore. And actually, I even have pieces that have cloth that I collected maybe 20, 30 years ago that I've never used and probably would not use as is in my work today. So that's some of the material that I alter. And then I often receive material from friends, and that is probably more meaningful because when they bring this gift to me, they have stories. It's a piece of cloth or from a dress that was meaningful to them. You know, I remember one friend brought me something, a piece from a dress, and she said that this was a dress that she used to like to wear when she took her kids to the park
Oh,
when they were little. You know,
that's
so
beautiful. Yeah.
yeah, and I get all kinds of stories like that. So I incorporate. The work will it's meaningful to me as I'm doing it, but often when the finished work is done, you know, don't know where the work, I mean, where the cloth came from, and nobody knows except me. So, you know, yeah, it's personal, and I enjoy that part of it. But yeah, I'm, as any quilter will tell you, they're I don't know what the addict about collecting cloth, you know. It's just I try not to buy new cloth anymore, but it's hard. It's
Yeah.
really very difficult because there's so much beautiful cloth out there. But now, yeah, I'm beginning to add other things since I can't buy cloth. I have let my creativity explore using different kinds of cloth. Early on, I would insist on only using cotton, but of course now everything is game. I can use whatever, not only wool, but oh, gee, I love linen. That's my new favorite, actually. I love working with linen. But some of the synthetics, even what do you call it? Cellophane, you know, just everything. I put straw pieces in burlap, all kinds of things. Because I'm dealing with texture now more than I was early on, you know. But I love just adding new, as I said, new vocabulary, new technology, new techniques.
My guest has been Detroiter and fiber artist Carol Harris. You can see her work in the exhibition The Threads of Time at the Flint Institute of Art. And her artist talk is happening this Saturday at 1 o'clock. It is free. Carol, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
That's all for Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.